Good morning and welcome to Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. My name is Lynn Smith and I'm the board rep today. I hope you've all had a good week. 1 week ago on Sunday, I was at a UU church in Woodstock, Vermont, and I lit a candle for our church and for our solar installation, which will actually begin in a little bit over 1 month and probably be done by the end of May. So the congregation there sends us all their best wishes and congratulations. We have a variety of announcements about church life and activities. There's some in the order of service, so be sure to read those. I'll start with one that's actually in the order of service that's not quite correct. The one on the back page, Work for Social Justice. These two events are happening this week, and you're welcome to join them to work for positive change in our area, both sponsored by Common Ground, which is a regional social issues group. If you'd like to go to those, please RSVP to Betsy Foss Campbell, and her email is in there. The first one is correct. It's Wednesday, this Wednesday at 7 o'clock at Church West. And then the second one is Thursday, so the date's right in there, March 17th, but the location has changed, I believe. It says Emmanuel Presbyterian Church.
The date and their location. Monday, March 21st.
Monday, March 21st, and it's at the Mason Temple Church of God and Christ on 35th Street. So you can contact Betsy Foss if you're interested in these. The menu for the future discussion group will be at 11:45 in Classroom 1 today. Please remember that next week, Saturday, March 19th, is our annual church retreat, beginning at 10:30 here at church. There's information about what you need to bring on a poster in the social hall. Please see Chris White or Carrie Duma if you have any questions. And Sue Blackwell would like to make an announcement.
Morning. I'd like to remind everybody that we're having our first day of tile decorating for the chalice that we're doing for the stewardship campaign. It will be in the meeting area, and we ask that you limit one tile per family because we're trying to keep the size of the chalice reasonable. But there will be paper and so that you can make your design before you do your glazing. There will be glazing available, so we hope you all participate and have some fun with it. I also want to remind you that we will have a dance. We're having a dance on April 9th to celebrate our stewardship. It'll be at 7 o'clock to 9:30. We have a band, and it should be a lot of fun. So please help us keep the flame alive, and we enjoy your participation. Thank you. And then Sue Lewis is going to do the testimony this morning for stewardship.
Well, at this time, I'd just like to have you greet those sitting around you. If you're visiting with us today, we particularly welcome you. Please sign the guest ledger. It's out in the foyer on the visitor's table. There's a variety of information available on that table about our church and Unitarian Universalism. Help yourself to any that interests you. I'll be in the social hall after the service if you have any questions about our church, or if you've been visiting for a while and would like information about becoming a member, I'd be happy to talk to you about that as well. If you're visiting us with your children, it's our custom for the kids to remain with us until after the offertory, at which time they go to their religious education classes. Your child is welcome to join them or remain in the service. And if you would like to go along to observe your child's class, please do so. There's a nursery just outside the doors, across the entryway here, if there's a need for child care during service. Classes will end at 11:15, at which time you can pick up your children from their classes. We always enjoy getting to know our guests. If there's any guests here today that would like to introduce themselves, or if you brought a guest you'd like to introduce, this would be a great time to do that. Welcome. Welcome. So everyone is invited to gather in the social hall after the service for refreshments, conversation, and painting the tiles. And just a reminder to put your cell phones on silent mode, please. Now Sue Lewis has a few words to say.
I always get a little worried when I'm asked to give a historical perspective on something because it makes me feel old. But I served on the church board during the time when the opportunity to take a leap of faith and purchase this church building arose. When we began to get serious about that proposal and about trying to pull together over $850,000 in cash and loans to do so, I contributed my grant writing skills to help us get there. As I worked on the proposal to the UUA and another proposal to banks for a loan, I realized in a way that hadn't previously been clear to me how important it was that this congregation had been guided by a strategic plan. Grant writing requires the ability to put forth a clear and convincing argument that the proposal being put forth was well planned, with supporting evidence of past, present, and a promise of future success. We had all of that, thanks to the work of the group that had put together the plan and to the congregation that had worked so hard to steward that plan into a reality. It's not to say the process was easy. It was terrifying to commit ourselves and to commit our church to raising funds in excess of anything we had ever dreamed of. We had some passionate arguments that led us to question some of our core values. And individually and collectively, we had to put our commitment to the test with real commitments of real dollars. And we had to ask for the kindness and support of both friends and strangers. But ultimately, that effort paid off. And if you look around the room right now and think about how many of us were there on Sunday nights in the rented basement of Jerusalem Presbyterian Church, it's amazing to think of what we've accomplished. We've been successful beyond our wildest early dreams at making LCUUC's vision and message ring throughout this area. And it would be really handy and really comfortable to sit back and say, we're done now. That we accomplished a huge task, that we more than doubled our membership. But there are still people in the Lake Country area who are looking for a church home that matches their values and their needs. We've updated our strategic plan and continue to make it grow. And we've made progress toward our primary goal of full-time professional ministry. I'm completely confident that the careful stewardship of this congregation by this congregation will lead us to success in our next great leap of faith.
Thank you, Sue. At this time, Karen is going to teach us a new hymn. It's in the new hymnal, number 1009. And she's going to teach us this now so that when we do it after our meditation time, she doesn't have to teach us at that time. So we'll know what we're doing, I think.
Yep, that's not going to work. Oh, it is not. Okay. We're all going to teach you this morning. So this is a beautiful hymn on meditation on breathing. This section over here, you're going to be the drone section, which is the bottom. You're going to kind of keep the beat for us. So it's the bottom line. So it's 1009. Breathe in, breathe out. And then this section over here is going to be the melody. and you're going to come in second. The drone section is going to be first, then the melody, and then the middle section is going to sing the middle part, the descant, and you'll come in last. Okay, so we're going to start right with this section and go from there.
Our speaker today, Paul Norton's with us. He's been a friend and a Buddhist teacher at this church for many years. He's currently in his eighth week here teaching a mindfulness meditation class. It's held on Monday evenings, and there's three more in that series, and all are welcome to attend that. I'm really happy to have Paul in the pulpit today. I found this to be a more than stressful week, I think, with all the news in Japan now and Libya and a little closer to home here in Madison. And whenever I'm with Paul in a class, it's just so calming, so I'm really happy he's here. Thank you, Paul, for coming.
Good morning.
Good morning, Paul.
In my tradition, we don't strike the bell. We invite the bell to wake up. We see the bell as the voice of the Buddha, asking us to wake up. May the sound of this bell penetrate the universe and even the darkest places. May living beings hear it clearly, so that understanding will arise in their hearts, their suffering will cease, and they will transcend the path of birth and death. Listen, listen, this wonderful sound brings us back to our true home. I, like many other people living in these modern times, can feel a little anger, fear, and despair at what is going on. But all I have to do is come to a gathering like this, and I am uplifted. I thank you all for watering the seeds of joy in me, and I look forward to a pleasant time here. Thank you.
Thank you.
a chalice, and please join in the congregational response.
Time for our story for all ages, and if the children would like to gather around, well, Paul tells the story for us.
Good morning, children. I want to tell you about they often call in my tradition my root teacher, the person who has given me my ordination, Thich Nhat Hanh. He is 84 years old now, which is really old, but has been, of course, at one time a child. At all of his retreats and talks, he always starts with a story for the children. And it's really very heartwarming because when I hear them, they're often the best part of the story. Today I'd like to give you a story that is actually from his own life when he was a little boy in Vietnam. And you can come closer if you want to see the pictures or not. It's called The Hermit and the Well. Do you guys know what a hermit is? A hermit, oh yes, you. Yes. I forget it. A hermit is a person who decides to live by himself so he isn't distracted by all of the people and the TVs and the iPhones and everything else, so that maybe he can become spiritually a little more calm and centered. And in Vietnam in particular, and many places in the world even now, the hermits are considered to be very sacred people, very smart and wise. People from there just contemplating in the forest. So this actually happened to him. When I was a child, I lived in North Vietnam. One day, our school teacher told the class that we were going on a trip to the top of a nearby mountain. He said that at the top of the mountain, there lived a hermit, a man who lived alone and sat quietly day and night to become peaceful like the Buddha. I had never seen a hermit before. I was very excited. The day before the trip, we made food for a picnic. We cooked rice, rolled it into balls, and wrapped the balls in banana leaves. We prepared sesame seeds, peanuts, and salt to dip the rice in. The morning of our trip, we walked for a long time until we came to the foot of a mountain. My friends and I climbed quickly as we could. We almost ran all the way up the mountain. When my friends and I finally reached the top, we were very tired. We had drunk all of our water on the way and did not have a single drop left. We looked around for the hermit. We looked and looked. Then we saw his hut made of bamboo and straw. Maybe he had heard us. Inside we discovered a small cot and an altar made of bamboo, but no hermit. Where was he? Maybe he had heard us coming up the mountain and was hiding somewhere away from the noise. It was time to have lunch, but I wasn't hungry. I was too tired and disappointed. Maybe if I wandered into the forest, I could find the hermit. I left my friends and started climbing further up the mountain. I was very thirsty. As I walked deeper into the forest, I heard the sound of dripping water. It was like the sound of music being softly played. I started to climb in the direction of that lovely sound. Soon I found a natural well, big rocks of many colors, surrounding a small pond. The water was so clear that I could see all the way to the bottom. I knelt down, scooped some water in my palms, and began to drink. The water tasted wonderfully sweet. You cannot imagine my happiness. It was delicious. I felt completely satisfied. I did not need or want anything at all. Even the desire to meet the hermit was gone. But suddenly realized I may have met the hermit after all. Maybe the hermit transformed himself into the well. Maybe he cared about me. This made me happy. I lay down on the ground next to the well and looked up at the sky. I saw the branch of a tree against the blue sky. I was very relaxed. Soon I fell into a deep sleep. I don't know how long I slept. When I awoke, I didn't know where I was. Then I saw the branch of the tree against the sky and the wonderful well. I remembered everything. It was growing dark, and it was time to go back to join my classmates. I said goodbye to the well and began to walk back down. As I walked out of the forest, a sentence formed in my heart. It was like a poem with only one line. I have tasted the best water in the world. My friends were glad to see me. They asked me where I had been, but I had no desire to talk. I wanted to keep my story to myself for a moment. I sat down on the ground and ate my lunch quietly. The rice and the sesame seeds tasted so good. I felt calm, happy, and peaceful. That was many years ago that I climbed that mountain. Now, I am an old man. But the image of the well and the sound of the dripping water are still alive inside me. Maybe you too have met your hermit. Maybe it was a rock, a tree, a star, or a beautiful sunset. The hermit is the Buddha inside of you. Thank you, children, for your kind attention. Would someone like to take the book with them? Yes? Do you have any questions about the story? I'll give you guys a little secret. In my tradition, the goal is to become a Buddha. Someone who is fully wakened up and knows how everything is going on around him at any time. And you, every single one of you, are a Buddha. Even at your little age, you have it all there. So it's wonderful, so you don't have to go off to far off China or go on some special retreat or some special temple. You just have to see the person next to you or look inside you. Isn't it wonderful? You're all Buddhas. So, go play like Buddhas.
Please stand as you're willing and able, and we'll sing hymn number 1000 in the small book, the new book. The morning has come. The offering is a sacrament of the free church, and it is freely given and received to help with the work of this institution. I want to emphasize that if you are a guest, you're not expected to donate to the offering. You're our guest, and you're welcome to be here with us. A sacred time in our service where we may share our joys and concerns with one another. You're invited to share personal sorrows and joys with our church community during this time. If you have a joy or concern to share, please you raise your hand and the usher will bring a microphone. And please just give your first name and the joy and concern you wish to share, and I'll light a candle for you. I will light our first candle in light of the terrible situation in Japan, with a terrible earthquake and an unknown number of people who are missing and who have died. And so I will light a candle of hope and for the people over there that lives may be saved and lives may be recovered. And I would recommend, what can we do here? I know the Red Cross has a special effort going on for Japan, earthquake and tsunami relief, and you might check with the Red Cross website and donate to them either directly or I guess you can do it by text messaging. So I will light this first candle for the people of Japan.
I'm Angel. Candle of joy. My daughter Sammy turned 24 on Friday, and it's been a while since there's been a Sammy update. She's doing wonderfully, working out, volunteering. She's got a boyfriend and one guy jealous. I mean, how normal is that for a 24-year-old? So she's doing really well, and I'm grateful for that.
I'm Karen. Two candles of concern, one for Sheila Larkin, friend of the church and musician that played here for a long time. She's broken her ankle and has been in the hospital for a week and is in rehab for, I don't know, she doesn't know how long, because she can't bear weight and she's had a stroke and can't use crutches, and so she's in a really tough spot, isn't going to be able to work and stuff for a while. She's in Stoughton in a rehab place. So that, and then also yesterday, my daughter Allie looks like tore her ACL again, and she had it replaced 2 years ago. And so it just was such a tough process. And so it looks like she's in for it again.
I'm Betsy. Would you light a candle of joy for my nephew who is getting married next weekend?
Hi, my name is Kaz, and light a candle of joy and concern. Joy, I was able to finally get in touch with my sister and my family in Japan, and they are doing well. They're back at home now. The train system was shut down. Highway was shut down to make sure that everything works, and also leave the highway open for rescue to go on, and so finally all those things are open now, south of Tokyo and south. However, northern part is still shut down. United Neighbor Vessel is out there now, parked in front of the affected areas, and they were doing a rescue mission. They just arrived, sometime last night our time, daytime, there. My sister tells me that it was the most horrific earthquake that she has felt, and she lives in south of Tokyo, which is about 200 and some miles away, right? So I couldn't possibly imagine what that magnitude was at the point. They say it's 8.9. They think it's higher because the machine broke. So that's pretty serious. But it was one of those, we are so used to earthquake, but so 7.some is something that we all have felt. But this one just lasted forever and ever and ever. All the buildings around Tokyo survived because it is retrofitted with earthquake. There are some minor building collapses and that sort of thing in Tokyo area, but mostly they're pretty good. Whole town is buried under the water, and it looks like a lake looking above it, but there were houses in there. So I don't know what the impact that would be. They are concerned about the nuclear plant that's affected by it. That was built against the protest. While Japan is, we know we are the country aware of what's the effect of a nuclear catastrophe is. So hopefully that will contain itself. Hopefully it will. Anyway, so they're doing fine. I went to Madison and protested yesterday. So I had a very emotional day yesterday. So, but thank you very much for concerns. Everybody giving me a call, and hope things will go well.
I'd like to light a candle of concern for my dear friends, Chris and Karen. Thursday afternoon, Chris's husband took his own life after a long struggle with alcoholism.
I'm Christy. Not to belabor Japan, but our daughter does have a friend there that she visited, in Nagoya, south of Tokyo, and thanks to Facebook, we were able to learn that she and her family are well.
Hi, my name is Tim. Could you write light a candle in memory of my father who passed away recently? He was 93, and it was not unexpected.
I'm Joanne, a candle for my brother who remains very ill and is now hospitalized with liver and renal failure.
And Sue, light a candle of joy. This is a time when we are particularly thankful for all of the great opportunities for music that are in our kids' lives. They're participating in a couple of national honor choirs, but particularly for Abby yesterday, who was able to overcome some kind of mental monkey on her back and qualified for state in solo one ensemble for violin.
Hi, I'm Julie. Could you light a candle of concern for my mom? She had double mastectomy back in October, and then went to California to rehabilitate and fell and broke her arm while she was there, and now came back to Wisconsin and had to have additional surgery, so she's had like 3 surgeries in the last 5 months and is staying with us to recuperate and was going to come this morning. I was all ready to introduce her and she didn't have a good night. So she said, can you ask him to pray for me?
I'd like to share a candle of joy. If you drive around the parking lot and drive around the building, you'll see many branches lined up along the driveway. Yesterday we had a group of our members that stepped up and brought chainsaws and handsaws and pruned all the trees around on the property. And it was just such a joy seeing how people pitch in around this place and really help out.
And a final candle for the joys and concerns which we keep in our hearts. Please pause for a minute of meditation, silent reflection. Please remain seated for our 3-part centering hymn number 109.
is my favorite book in the world. Peace is every step. It's what got me on this path. And I wanted to read a passage called The Dandelion Has My Smile. In a few short weeks, we will have dandelions everywhere, and we'll see them as noxious weeds. And perhaps after this reading, you might look at them a little differently. If a child smiles, if an adult smiles, this is very important. If in our daily lives we can smile, if we can be peaceful and happy, not only we, but everyone will profit from it. If we really know how to live, what better way to start the day than with a smile? Our smile affirms our awareness and determination to live in peace and joy. The source of a true smile is an awakened mind. How can you remember to smile when you wake up? You might hang a reminder, such as a branch, a leaf, a painting, or some inspiring words in your window or from the ceiling above your bed, so that you notice it when you wake up. Once you develop the practice of smiling, you may not need a reminder. You may smile as soon as you hear a bird singing or see the sunlight streaming through your window. Smiling helps you approach the day with gentleness and understanding. When I see someone smile, I know immediately that he or she is dwelling in awareness. This half smile, how many artists have labored to bring it to the lips of countless statues and paintings? I am sure the same smile must have been on the faces of the sculptors and painters as they worked. Can you imagine an angry painter giving birth to such a smile? Mona Lisa's smile is light, just a hint of a smile. Yes, even a smile like that is enough to relax all the muscles in our face, to banish all worries and fatigue. A tiny bud of a smile on our lips nourishes awareness and calms us miraculously. It returns us to the peace we thought we had lost. Our smile will bring happiness to us and those around us. Even if we spend a lot of money on gifts for everyone in our family, nothing we buy could give them as much happiness as the gift of our awareness, our smile. And this precious gift costs nothing. At the end of a retreat in California, a friend wrote this poem. I have lost my smile, but don't worry, the dandelion has it. If you have lost your smile and yet are capable of seeing that the dandelion is keeping it for you, the situation is not too bad. You still have enough mindfulness to see that the smile is there. You only need to breathe consciously one or two times and you will recover your smile. The dandelion is one member of your community of friends. It is there, quite faithful, keeping your smile for you. And so, dear friends, when all of those dandelions start popping up and you're annoyed by all of that because they're making your lawn look so ratty, think of them as smile keepers. Something happens. So how did you feel during that pause? Were you thinking, okay, what happens next? Why is the talk going like this? Did he have a stroke or something? A big episode of stage fright? Did you notice your desire to want something to happen, to move forward, to solve something, make something happen? Welcome to your frog nature. This is demonstrated in the following poem by Thich Nhat Hanh, which I believe is in all of your inserts. Froglessness. The first fruition of the practice is an attainment of froglessness. When a frog is put on the center of a plate, she will jump out of the plate after just a few seconds. If you put the frog back again on the center of the plate, she will again jump out. You have so many plans. There is something you want to become. Therefore, you always want to make a leap forward. It is difficult to keep the frog still on the center of the plate. You and I both have Buddha nature in us. That is encouraging that you and I both have frog nature in us. That is why the first attainment of the practice, froglessness, is its name. And the same author, Thich Nhat Hanh, who's obviously the person who wrote the story or who experienced the story of the hermits on the well, and you can see the influence of that. At the beginning of the story, he's a very froggy boy, isn't he? He has this ambition, he has this plan, he's going to see the hermit. And after he has sort of deflated and sad, and his froggy nature has been deflated, then he finally meets the hermit. So how many times have we missed our hermit, our source of wisdom? How many times have we been full of our frogginess, leaping ahead and then again and again? All these lily pads, they seem inadequate, and this other one looks inviting, so there we go, we hop to that lily pad and then another, restlessly looking but never seeing. Driven, it's a great word for this. We are being driven in a vehicle by our frog nature who doesn't want to stop for gas or directions. And there's a word for the type of meditation that we often do called shamatha. Shamatha means stopping. This whirlwind world is upon us, and while this froggy tendency we have has always been with us, we have a culture that promotes our frogginess. Nothing is more demonstrative of this than our blitz of electronic media. When we have nothing to do, we check out an email, send a text, check NPR, make a call, check CNN, check ESPN, read a paragraph or two in a magazine, read a paragraph or two in a website, microwave something, eat it mindlessly, check our email, check our other email, retrieve our voicemail, reheat the coffee, scan the newspaper, check our to-do list, eat a donut, paste, text again, check our email, surf the web, pick up a few clothes, see what's going on cable. Whoa. Let's stop for a moment. I think one of our lost arts is to do nothing. I mean, to actually see nothing as something to do. For nothing is not this great void or wasted space. The state of nothing is where we can meet ourselves and perhaps know ourselves in a way we have not considered. In this busy world, we have become human doings. Perhaps we should explore what it's like to be human beings. We can embrace shamatha and experience the absence of this madness, this driven frogginess. The treadmill we are running on doesn't seem to be taking us anywhere. And often, all we're doing is running from ourselves. Self-knowledge does not come so much as from driving in as it does from backing off. Less from forging ahead and more from letting go. So let's contrast the doing minds and the being mind. The doing mind is swept away by immediate judgment, aware, and perhaps fearful of the differences it sees between ourself and the other. The being mind lets things be and let us observe before reacting. The doing mind wants to get going and is concerned with our past, our regrets, and the future, our to-do list and our projects. The being mind, in contrast to getting going, wants to get staying, just to rest in the present moment. The doing mind is impulsive, seeing all these suggestions that come to us as thoughts, as urgent commands. The being mind sees thoughts as mental events, as suggestions only to be reflected on. The being mind does not believe everything it thinks. The doing mind is often acting out of avoidance and fear. And the being mind is reflecting and accepting, taking a while to see what is what. The doing mind is so often automatic. The being mind is more intentional. I often attend meetings at Children's Hospital, and at the hospital, I tend to get there around 6:45, shifts at 7, and I see everybody rushing in to the hospital. And I know that they have plenty of time, but it looks like everybody's in this mad sprint. And I wish that they could just kind of slow down, I want to take them and say, you don't have to go that fast. You can take this slower. Even if they were in a hurry, and I know because of how their shifts change that most of them aren't, even just taking that extra 5 minutes to get to work might be good. And maybe by the time they got to their floors and their stations, they'd be more aware for their patients and their families and their coworkers. And I see kids walking into exam rooms. I work as a developmental behavioral pediatrician, and they can't let go of their handheld games. They're walking in with their handheld games. And I see people on the roads weaving in and out of traffic, way over the speed limit, not caring what that might be regarding danger or the stress on the environment. And nearly every day I see someone who would love to meditate. Oh, meditation's a great thing, but I'm just way too busy. There are frogs everywhere. So I wanted to give also in your handout, in your flyer, a little thing that I have tacked on my wall in my office above my desk. It's these four checkpoints that Thich Nhat Hanh has brought forward about how we might be able to act with our being mind, with our Buddha nature instead of our frog nature, in the concept called wise view. The first checkpoint is, am I sure? Something happens, am I sure? Often we are caught up in the moment and we make mistakes. And Thich Nhat Hanh has often said that with perception, there is deception. Our frog nature needs to jump to conclusions, pun intended. The classic story is that we can see is when we walk through a forest and we see a coil and we immediately see it as a snake and then we find out that it was merely a rope. And this scenario is really obvious, but many of the time we have this enormous frog reaction and we continue to see things as snake and we refuse to reevaluate or to look deeper. We see the coworker who didn't get the report done as lazy, and the friend who passed us on the street as inconsiderate, and the politicians on the other side as cold-hearted, and Chicago Bears fans as deluded. And the list goes on and on. It's not that we can keep ourselves from making judgments. We will always make judgments. While I have been teaching my mindfulness-based stress reduction classes, and that's what my present class has sort of evolved out of, they came upon this principle called non-judgment, and I always had a problem with that. I liked the idea of called mindfulness of judgment, and because they needed seven things, I replaced it with froglessness. And it wasn't until after I reflected on this a little bit that I realized that froglessness is the characteristic that people would call non-judgment. To be swept away by your judgment is frog nature. To reflect is allow judgment to become partner in our actions, not a bully. And therefore, we sit with our froglessness and reflect. The second checkpoint, what am I doing? We should act mindfully, and our actions should be thoughtful, kind, and appropriate. Often we say things that are not true. Often we do things according to our own agenda rather than the greater good. Do our actions and words help? Even if they're true, do they help? It may be the frogless thing to say or do nothing and just allow things to be. This is really true in meetings, isn't it? People have this idea that they have to kind of say something or else they're not really participating. The third checkpoint is hello, habit energy. Our ingrained ways of doing things, our long health patterns, are easy to once again fall into. How much of what we might say or do is the result of our automatic actions? We have used them before. Maybe they were even successful then. We will most likely be wise, however, if we look at every moment as a fresh occurrence. We can only do this when we train to see that our habit energy has often insidiously hijacked the train. And the fourth checkpoint is called bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is loosely translated as the true heart and mind of love. It is the wellspring of kindness. It is the hub of connection. It is the source of love. Many people who come to the path that I'm on and have noticed that I and others have taken this contemplative path and they want to become clearer about how they see the world and how they are doing things. It's a great idea and it works. while it's true that the contemplative life leads to better decision making, it is also apparent the further you go along that the answer, the one answer, is impossible. There's a nice Chinese saying I like to use. To be uncertain is uncomfortable, but to be certain is ridiculous. We are all just taking our best guesses. They're better guesses if you live a mindful and frogless life, but their guess is just the same. So when given a lot of choices, and you're not exactly sure, and you need to make that sort of thing, you often try to dig and dig and dig for more information. Sometimes more information is not really there. I've found many people who are used to meditating, instead of digging for information, will pull out their cushion and sit for 15 minutes and make a lot better choices. When in doubt, choose the kinder option. When in doubt, follow your bodhicitta. Will you sometimes make the wrong decision and maybe even seem foolish? Sure, that'll happen. But if we all row in the same direction, the better off we are. The more we extend and open our bodhicitta heart, the more wonderful the world will be. All of this, I appreciate, takes practice, but it is all doable. Once Thich Nhat Hanh was feeling a little frustrated in a large crowd. He was trying to do walking meditation and was having difficulty. He was actually in the city of Prague and there were a lot of people around. He was popular and he was trying to figure out which way to go and how to do this walking meditation. And he said, this is ridiculous. He says, I give up. I can't do this. I can't lead this meditation. I'm going to let the Buddha do it. And so he opened up and he had his Buddha nature come out, and that's how he led the walking meditation. And you all have Buddha nature. Every single one of you, whether you believe it or not, you all have Buddha nature, and everyone around you has Buddha nature, and even your old weird uncle has Buddha nature, and even Scott Walker has Buddha nature. Everyone has Buddha nature. So perhaps when we're tired, or frustrated, or we're not sure what to do, and we can't make that decision, maybe we can drop by and say, I'm tired, I'm confused, I'm weary, I'm just going to let the Buddha do it. And perhaps maybe you'll make more and better decisions that way. We all wish to be better people, better parents, and better partners, better employers and better workers, better teachers and better students, and better citizens and friends. It starts with taking a little time. It starts with that froglessness. That reactive mind has not always treated you so well. Take time to smell the flowers. Take time to taste the coffee. Take time to see the sunset and the full moon. Take time to hear the spring birds. Take time to see the eyes of the child, even the 80-year-old ones. The best news that Gautama Siddhartha told us is that we are all Buddhas. So maybe we should start acting like one. Be awake. Be alive. Be.
Please rise as you're willing and able and join in singing hymn number 168. The order of service is incorrect. It's hymn number 168, step by step.
Thank you.
a few minutes for our monologue. I think we're going to have to keep it a little bit on the short side and continue discussions with Paul after, during coffee hour. But if any of you have any comments or questions for Paul, please raise your hand and usher bring the microphone for you.
I just wanted to say that, first of all, that there's a misprint this week only because of the topic of the sermon. This particular period is called the polywalk. So, I'm sorry, you know, I couldn't. It was right there, so I couldn't do anything. Is there anybody that has questions or comments about froglessness or anything along those lines, or the day, or losing an hour is the shortest day of the year? We all lost an hour. So, anyone?
My name is
Paul. I have a microphone coming your way.
My name's Barb. I was recently fortunate enough to have a rather terrible injury. It's not that terrible, it's healing, but it has kept me immobilized for going on 5 weeks now, more or less. And I've had a few glimpses of staying on the flight. And we want so much, but that's not the way it comes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your share.
Hi, I'm John, and thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us today and bringing us into the present. I found your words very meaningful, and the whole service very meaningful for allowing us time to think and reminding us to think and not react, and it's all good.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I got your name, Lori. What is her comment about how when things go wrong, that they're often looked at as these tremendous difficulties, when in reality they can be mindfulness belts, giving us the opportunity to reflect on what's going on. I can think of, you know, I had my knee in a knee brace for two months once, and I remember very much what it was like to walk afterwards. My goodness, what a joy. And those little difficulties that come along are often those ways that we appreciate how things are going. And when your knee is in a brace, you have to be a little frogless, you know. You have to sort of sit and take that in the way it is. So, thank you.
Hello, my name is Leanne, and thank you for your wonderful words today. I just wanted to ask, you're speaking to a group of big-time doers here, and I just wanted to ask if you could say something about the difference between doing as trying to make a difference in the world as opposed to doing nothing.
Yes.
If you know what I mean.
Thank you. I certainly didn't want to give people the impression that we should just sit on our cushions and do nothing and let the world fall in around us. But I would say that many times people do things out of this really restless energy, and they make mistakes when they're doing. So maybe if you're doing 12 things, you could do 9. And maybe you could do one thing really well instead of multitasking and doing 3 things. If nothing else, your ability to know yourself is better, but I think that you also get things done better. This is something that we have been teaching spiritually for a long time in Buddhist circles, but there's now good scientific evidence that people that multitask don't do well, and that when you have so many things going on. I think a lot of it is related to how you're doing things. If you're doing things with thought and patience and kindness, and deliberateness, I think that you do pretty well. If you're doing things out of urgency and being rushed, even things that have as their overall project to make the world better, it may not be so. Many people who were in the peace movement in the 60s and 70s when Thich Nhat Hanh was around were incredibly mindless people, very, you know, angry and upset, and it didn't really serve the purpose well. And so keep doing whatever good work you're doing, but pause and reflect and see how it all comes and unfolds. Thank you.
Hi, Paul. It's great. One of the concepts in Buddhism that I've struggled with the most is probably the concept of being non-judgmental. Mm-hmm. I've always been in the judgment business and trying to make good judgments. So I appreciated the comment you made about rather than being non-judgmental, being mindfully judgmental. So I'd love if you'd expand on that a little bit.
Yes. And I actually find in Buddhist circles it was very interesting that I heard this all the time. There were two things that I would generally hear. A, be non-judgmental. B, go out and vote. Now, you can't really kind of reconcile those things. The idea would be reflect, because our initial response with judgment, is often wrong, and being froggy in nature and responding to that is what might be a problem. For example, there are two people. One is a realtor, and I forget what the other one is, who is lives in Madison, and their name is Scott Walker. Their addresses are known. They're getting lots of hate mail because people look at that and say, Scott Walker, I don't like Scott Walker. And these guys are just like trying to make a living. They're like regular people. That's an obvious thing, but we do that sort of thing. We see somebody who is, say, if somebody walked in here dressed like the Hell's Angels, we would have a certain viewpoint about them, when they may be the most kind and gentle person in the world. And having that kind of step back to reflect, judgment is absolutely essential for our survival. You go out in your car, you have to judge whether you can make that stoplight or not. That's a judgment, and we do this all the time. But the idea that we can get swept away by the judgment that is based on fear, anger, despair, that kind of wolf in us that is full of this survival mode, that everything must be seen as enemy. We have that. We all have that. By saying that we all have Buddha nature, which is true, what we also have is discursive mind and Mara nature, Mara being the opposite of Buddha in that. And we always have to be aware that those kinds of things come together. So reflection is always good. But judgment happens.
Yeah. Could we just take, can we have two more questions and then let's go here and then one over here.
I just want to make two comments. One on the non-judgment piece also. It seems like our cognitive minds really are evolved, as you were saying, for kind of constant judgment. So that chattering that's going on in your mind, good and bad thoughts about what is happening, judgments about whether something's scary or safe. And that doesn't necessarily mean those things are all true, but they will come into your mind pretty much constantly. So that's one comment. I guess the other thing around the doing is, it seems like a lot of doing comes out of an inability to really tolerate emotion, fear of emotion. So when we have emotion, we judge it either good or bad, and then we feel like, okay, I have to do something right now because I can't sit with this anxiety or sadness.
Yeah.
And I guess being mindful that those emotions also always happen, like weather.
Yes. Thank you.
It's okay.
We all know that there's escape in things like overeating and taking substances and gambling. We all know those things happen, that people who often do that have a difficult time seeing what's what. Overwork is the same way, or overdoing is the same way. And so, again, reflect if what you're doing. Do you ever have time to sit and say, how am I doing? How do I feel about this? And if you're finding that you don't really have that particular thing, maybe you are doing a little bit too much. And it's like, you know, you get these things multiplied, especially if they're really good causes. Of course I should be doing this. I mean, you know, I work in the healthcare profession and it's really good, or I'm helping, I've got to do all this and do it. It not always doesn't work that really well. And if you're not really present for your clients and patients and friends, it may not work as well. You've been trying, I know.
I have been trying.
Yes.
I just wanted to comment about dandelions. I've been doing a lot of research on old seeds, because I want to use old seed packets for our garden outside as markers. And in the 1920s, you could buy dandelion seeds. So there's this one packet, and I plan on marking the dandelion seeds out there. But what you said also made me start thinking about that, you know, as kids, I mean, I remember collecting dandelions, and probably most of us do, and I taught preschool for a while. And kids love dandelions. They have to be taught to see them as weeds. And that kind of just fascinates me. We were never taught that dandelions were weeds when we think was beautiful every time they come out.
Maybe it's on the front of the cover here about that, yeah. Thank you all for your kind attention. Once again, I'm grateful for how you've been watered my seeds of joy. And I'd like to read one of my favorite poems. I just read it in class, so those people who are in the class are going to listen to this again in 6 days. It's called Keeping Quiet by Pablo Neruda. And there's three parts of it. I'd like to editorialize a little bit before. The first is how we threaten ourselves with death. That's what we do. That's our real core difficulty, is we threaten ourselves with death. He talks about that in there. And he also talks about how we can remember how things seem to be dead and later become alive, which is what we get to see in the springtime, don't we? All of those branches that seem to be inert, not doing anything for many months, will suddenly have buds and leaves, and all of the ground will grow, the grass will become green, and the flowers will occur. But mostly I like the whole poem, Keeping Quiet, because it's an anthem to froglessness. Keeping quiet. Now, we will count to 12 and we'll all keep still. For once, on the face of the earth, let's not speak in any language. Let's stop for 1 second and not move our arms so much. It would be an exotic moment without rush, without engines. We would all be together in a sudden strangeness. Fishermen in the cold sea would not harm whales, and the man gathering salt would look at his hurt hands. Those who prepare green wars, wars with gas, wars with fire, victories with no survivors, would put on clean clothes and walk about with their brothers in the shade doing nothing. What I want should not be confused with total inactivity. Life is what it's about. I want no truck with death. If we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving and for once could do nothing, perhaps a huge silence might interrupt this sadness of never understanding ourselves and of threatening ourselves with death. Perhaps the earth can teach us, as when everything seems dead and later proves to be alive. Now I'll count to 12 and you keep quiet and I will go.